This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. Joining us today on the show is Frank Colucci, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University Northwest. We'll get the latest on the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the United States Supreme Court last week and what it means for the Constitution, and just how far will the Supreme Court and Republicans go in removing many basic freedoms that we've seen for the last several decades. Following that conversation, we'll be talking with U.S. Representative of District 1, Frank Mervan, about the latest here in Northwest Indiana, including a recent tour that he had across the region, as well as the latest on the USW contract talks, and again, the future of Roe v. Wade at a national level. Welcome to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. She's Dee Dotson. And on the line joining us today is Frank Colucci, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University Northwest. Frank, good morning to you, wherever you are on vacation this month.
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Dee. Happy to talk to everyone about going on in the Supreme Court.
And for those of you who are tuning in, and Frank's voice sounds a little familiar, you might remember him from election night coverage here on Lakeshore Public Radio. So, Frank, thank you so much for taking time out of your summer vacay to come chat with us. A lot of news happening over the last week on the United States Supreme Court, and more news expected to drop tomorrow as the court is expected to release another opinion. Frank, getting started, the big news, obviously, last week was the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade. As somebody who's watched the court for the last couple of several years, I should say, what was your reaction to Friday's opinion? And was there anything in particular about the decision and opinion that stood out to you?
Okay, Tom, as a political scientist, I look at this decision as part of a long-term trend. It's actually the culmination of a focused, intentional, 40-year effort to overturn Roe versus Wade, focused not just on the court itself, but indirectly through elections, through presidential elections, through elections for U.S. Senate, through elections to state legislatures as well. Going back about almost exactly 30 years ago, in June of 1992, the court came within one vote of overturning Roe versus Wade in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where by a 5-4 vote, the court upheld the core holding of Roe versus Wade. And again, last week's decision overturned not just Roe, but Casey as well, and the constitutional right to an abortion. But the one thing that I think has happened, particularly in the, not just 4 years, but particularly the last 30 years, is this intense focus on the Supreme Court, on presidential nominations for the Supreme Court. Trump promised that he would nominate three justices. If he nominated three justices to the Supreme Court, they'd be pro-life, and they'd overturn Roe, quote-unquote, automatically. So if you look at from the presidential side, from the Senate side, as well as from the Supreme Court side, unfortunate death of Antonin Scalia, his seat not filled, by Barack Obama, held up by the Senate. Mm-hmm. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death in late 2020, right before the presidential election, Republican president, Republican Senate, that seat was filled. So I think I try to look at this decision in this larger, broader political context of aimed at the Supreme Court, but not only shaped by the Supreme Court. We have to think of it as a larger context at the state, at the federal level, and as we'll probably talk about in a few minutes, elections at the state level as well.
Absolutely.
Enacting these new laws
Absolutely,
over the last 30 years.
So let's get into the Supreme Court really quick. Briefly, as you just mentioned, then-President Donald Trump was able to appoint three Supreme Court justices because following the failure from the Obama administration to appoint a Supreme Court justice following the death of Antonin Scalia. Then President Obama had nominated Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland did not even get a hearing in front of the Senate. Instead, Mitch McConnell said there's an upcoming election, let the voters decide. And the popular vote decided on Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. Of course, we know all about now the that wasn't the case in terms of the Electoral College, instead going with President at the time GOP nominee Donald J. Trump, and then becoming president. And Trump was then able to fill Antonin Scalia's position, able to garner a resignation to fill another spot, and then the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. My question, with all of that in context, at this point, is the presidential election really an election for the United States Supreme Court?
You know, I'd go a little further. I would say not only are presidential elections elections about the U.S. Supreme Court, but actually U.S. Senate elections are elections about the U.S. Supreme Court as well, about which sort of nominees will get a hearing, will not get a hearing, or will actually be confirmed to the court. I think one key story about Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination is that if the Democrats did not win the two Senate elections in Georgia in January of 2021, then there would not be a 50-50 Senate with Vice President Harris breaking the tie, and thus there would not be sufficient votes even hold a hearing for Ketanji Brown Jackson if that didn't happen. So I think we have to kind of see that. Again, our Constitution says four Supreme Court justices nominated by the president, advising consent of the Senate. And it was built that way. The judiciary was intended to be Article III, a branch certainly one appointed by the executive, Article II, and approved by the Senate, part of Article I. That's part of our political structure. The Supreme Court is inherently, in its composition, a branch dependent on the result of presidential and U.S. Senate elections.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about the U.S. Senate aspect of things, but you're absolutely right. And
one thing I should point out, about the U.S. Senate,
yeah,
is the importance in 2018 in a state like Indiana that had a Democratic senator, Joe Donnelly, and his defeat, along with the defeat of other Democratic senators in states like Missouri and Montana. Kept the majority for the Republicans in the Senate, even though the Democrats took control of the House. And that reality allowed for the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett in late 2020. So you kind of have to see them both together, both not just with the Garland nomination, but you have to see this president in the Senate play a central role in the composition of the Supreme Court, that you kind of need both of them, at least in current politics. You'll need control of both of them if you'd want to install justice on the federal Supreme Court and to assure justices on the lower federal courts as well.
Which is something that then-President Trump did at a breakneck pace. He appointed over 200 lifetime appointments to judges, many of whom were lawyers who had never even tried a case. And that was something that was really set forth, again, years ago, not only by Mitch McConnell, but through other Republican leaders as well, and basically stacking the lower courts, so much so to the point that it was nearly impossible to go ahead and get Barack Obama to appoint any of those positions, because a lot of those seats were left open again, because despite the fact that then President Obama had an 8-year term, two separate terms, obviously 4 and 4 for president, the first two were a supermajority. He then lost the, as presidents often do in midterms, lost that majority bid, got a little bit back over the corresponding next couple of years, but never saw the power that he had for those first 2 years. Therefore, he could not fill all of those lower seats that President Trump then, with supermajorities for the first 2 years, was literally able to just shoehorn people in to those spots that they can basically sit in forever and completely alter the political landscape of the country, and they don't even have to go to the Supreme Court. That process, you know, as dictated by the Constitution, and you know, is that something that is just glossed over when it comes to learning about the American you know, political system, or is that just sort of the, that's just how it's done and that's how it's always been done? What can you say to that point about the stacking of not necessarily the Supreme Court but all of those lower seats as well?
Well, let me put it this way. It is a system provided for in the Constitution. When I teach Political Science 101, we do the judiciary. I love to have a short clip, actually, from 2019, a Trump rally in Kentucky with Mitch McConnell there as well, talking about how McConnell talks about how Trump has remade the new judiciary, and how Trump sarcastically says the one thing that I want to thank Barack Obama for is leaving all these judge openings for him.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, McConnell did it for him. On the other hand, let me say this. One story that has certainly gone under the radar this year is that the Biden administration and the Democrats in the Senate know this, and they have actually nominated and confirmed a substantial number for the first 2 years of lower court nominees. Democratic judges maybe got the hint from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and ones that are close to retirement took senior status to open their position. And Democrats have actually done, finally, in these first 2 years, even with their very bare majority, that's why holding the Senate majority is so important, even if there are particular senators you may not like, the fact that your party holds a majority means you can set the legislative agenda and the calendar for nominations, including judicial nominations. And Democrats this year have done very well in filling these openings in 2021 and 2022. But yeah, you have to think of them both together. And I think both parties, Republicans have known this for years. Democrats are finally getting the hint that if you actually want to have effective nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court, given the end of the filibuster for Supreme Court and for other nominations, that you do need to have control of the presidency and a majority control of the Senate.
We're talking with Frank Colucci, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University Northwest, here on Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. She's Dee Dotson.
Professor Colucci, I just have a question. So before we get into the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to even overturn Roe v. Wade, I just have to ask, why do you believe the draft opinion was leaked in the first place? What was the motivation?
You know, I can't answer that question. We don't have a good answer of who did it. There are plausible arguments on both sides. Maybe it was leaked by someone who wanted to sound the alarm about this opinion. Maybe it was leaked by someone who wanted to get the news out in front and maybe deaden the reaction to it. The one thing that from watching the Supreme Court, we kind of could tell is that the decision was going to come down to overturn Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. And we knew this probably as soon as January.
Right.
Oral arguments in this case were in December. If you recall, in January, Texas's law, their abortion law, was brought to the Supreme Court and asked the court to issue an emergency stay. The court issues a stay in cases where a party is extremely likely to win. The court, by a 5-4 vote, did not issue the stay, saying that Texas's six-week abortion law, at least letting it go into effect. And that decision kind of was even more of a hint than the leaked draft that Roe versus Wade would be overturned. By not putting a stay on Texas's law, which was clearly in violation of Roe and Casey, the court was kind of giving a hint that, you know, we're going to do something and likely overrule Roe and Casey. We actually did have a bit noticed. The leaked draft just reinforces that.
Frank, before we get into the discussion about what kind of an impact this might have here in Indiana as the State General Assembly gets set to meet right after the July 4th holiday, let's talk about we've seen, I think, a lot of tweets. We've seen Instagram posts from individuals. We've seen posts on Facebook that you know, not only has Roe been overturned, but they're also looking at, you know, based on Judge Clarence Thomas's writings, you know, looking at same-sex marriage. They're looking at interracial marriage, as well as any sort of contraception and contraceptive use for couples or and or individuals. The framework, of course, being stripping away the rights that you have as an individual and putting it towards the state. So is there a greater play at hand? We just talked about some of the you know, the mechanics of the political machine, so to speak, in terms of what kind of an impact not being able to win, you know, a senatorial race in 2018 has on political appointments for lower court judges. We've seen what kind of an impact it has now for not winning a presidential race, for being able to put three of your party into the Supreme Court. So now, is this, has Clarence Thomas sort of set the steps or set the next precedent in motion when it comes to those types of decisions? Or is that just sort of a fantasy land that he lives in, and the U.S. Supreme Court isn't ready to take those things on yet?
I think there are actually two ways to go in that answer. You can tell me which way you want to go first. We can talk about what Indiana might do, and we can talk about what the Supreme Court might do.
Let's look at the Supreme Court first here.
Okay, I think Clarence Thomas has made his opinion pretty clear about what are called unenumerated constitutional rights, or rights not expressly listed in the Constitution, in his opposition to that and to a doctrine called substantive due process, which we can talk about later. And not just Roe, but other key cases involving same-sex marriage, striking laws criminalizing same-sex sexual activity, even laws involving contraception, all are exercises of substantive due process, or put another way, exercises of liberty protected under the 14th Amendment of our Constitution. That they are all these precedents, and some other ones as well, including the right to raise and to educate your children, all are these rights that are not expressly listed in the Constitution, but have been recognized by courts and by many by the bulk of American society, marriage, decisions about marriage, family, child raising, mm-hmm. not expressly listed in the Constitution. Education as a right not listed there. But there are ones that the court has recognized as rights protected by our Constitution, particularly under the Ninth Amendment, which says that we have additional rights, including ones not expressly enumerated in the Constitution.
Frank,
if you start pulling at that strand, as the court does in this case, then those similar arguments, and particularly an argument based on original understanding or as text and tradition, might leave those other rights certainly in judicial jeopardy. Thomas is very express about this, yet the majority opinion tries to give a justification why abortion is unique.
We're talking with Frank Colucci, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University Northwest, here on Regionally Speaking. Frank, let's shift gears now and talk about Indiana. July 6th, there's going to be a special session. What it was originally supposed to be, the inflation session, and hoping to send Hoosiers a couple of $100 extra because of the extra tax dollars that Indiana was able to basically stow away for the last several years during the COVID pandemic and giving those back to Hoosiers. But now, Governor Holcomb and state lawmakers and leaders have put this as the abortion abortion session. A lot of states have trigger laws that have already gone into effect following Friday's decision to end Roe v. Wade. Indiana, though, does not have those trigger laws in effect. Abortion, as of today, you know, just a week before the July 6th special session, is still legal. What is Indiana going to do here come July 6th?
Well, let me say that the Indiana Assembly, and particularly Republicans of the Assembly, we're looking forward to a general session. They had actually written a letter in the spring to the governor, to Governor Holcomb, saying that if the Supreme Court should overturn or narrow Roe versus Wade, we would ask you to call a special session so that we can make abortion laws that could further protect life and potential life. So this is something that the Indiana General Assembly and Republicans in the Assembly had kind of hoped for in the special assembly for the special session for the rebate and the surplus provides an opportunity for that.
And I should note, Frank, that letter to Governor Holcomb did come out after the leaked memo, correct?
I believe it was before.
Okay, it was before then. Okay. So they were gearing up. They, you know, I guess they maybe could smell the winds of change, so to speak, at the Supreme Court level. Okay.
Right, the oral argument and the inaction on the Texas case not staying that law during appeal were a pretty clear signal. Now, what laws Indiana is likely to pass? Probably a good example is to look at some neighboring states. And I think neighboring states like Ohio and other states have either decided on either a 6-week or a 12-week ban on abortion after those periods. Ohio just recently passed a 6-week law. Current Indiana law is 22 weeks based on viability. But I would say 6 to 12 weeks, maybe more like, I would say probably a little bit more likely that that 6 weeks would be the choice. And they might also have some other regulations as well, including regulations that have been struck by other federal courts. For example, about sex-selective abortions, or a controversial law from a couple of years ago, which would advise women that were taking the pill-based abortion, that perhaps that procedure could be reversible. But those might be laws that Indiana's General Assembly might want to reconsider or reenact based on the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs last week.
We're talking with Frank Colucci, Associate Professor of Political Science here at Lakeshore Public Radio, on Regionally Speaking, about the United States Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade last week and what kind of an impact it has, not only for the country, but here in Indiana as well, especially as the state's General Assembly gets set to convene here on July 6th, just after the 4th of July holiday. And Frank, what do you see coming next down the pipeline? We've got another Supreme Court decision being an opinion being released tomorrow, Wednesday. Many people thinking that it might deal with EPA regulations. Do you have any sort of an idea as to what could be coming down the pipeline, and or what do you expect from the rest of the summer session?
I think the court will likely finish up this week, and I think the key cases will involve federal regulation of the environment, the EPA case, as well as an issue of border policy from the Biden administration. I certainly foresee that the conservative side will win both of those cases. And I think they'll probably most likely come down tomorrow and end the term then. Even looking forward to next year, there are some other cases as well, and cases involving the constitutionality of the use of race in university admissions. There are two paired cases, one from Harvard University, one from the University of North Carolina, that the court has already granted cert and that they'll hear argument for in next term, starting in next October. And they'll also hear a case challenging a Louisville city ordinance prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, challenged by a wedding photographer who says that it will violate her free speech or free exercise of religion rights to be compelled as a commercial photographer to give her services to same-sex marriage.
And that photographer as well.
Coming up next term.
and that photographer as well, was not actually asked by any same-sex couples to photograph a wedding, but it was just more along the lines of, hypothetically, this could happen, as opposed to the cupcake bakery here in Indiana that we dealt with. Really quick, Frank, one last question for you before we need to go ahead and let you go and get back on a well-earned vacation. Is there any merit to stacking the Supreme Court? Do you see that as a potential option for Democrats?
Again, as we were talking about earlier, under the Constitution does not say how many justices should be on the Supreme Court. That is entirely left to Congress, and that has changed over American history. We started out with 6 justices originally. We've gone up to 9 and even 10 for a short time during the Civil War, and then back to 9. That's entirely up to Congress. So if you would want to add justice to the Supreme Court, that would have to be legislation passed by the House and by the Senate through with the 60-vote filibuster, and then signed by the president, unless you overturn the filibuster. I don't foresee 60 votes for that proposition. And currently, there's not support in the Democratic Party to do that. But again, as with most things, if there's one lesson I'd like to talk about the Supreme Court today, is that certainly the Supreme Court, its decisions have political consequences. That said, your political decisions, particularly your political decisions at the ballot box, for Senate, for president, and even for state legislature and governor, have an important effect on constitutional law.
Frank Colucci, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University Northwest, joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Frank, thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the rest of vacation, and I think we'll probably be talking again sometime in November.
Okay, great to talk to you, Tom. Great to talk to you, Dee. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your time. And joining us in studio in just a moment is United States Representative of District 1, Frank J. Mervan, here on Regionally Speaking. Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. She's Dee Dotson, and he's U.S. Representative Frank Mervan from District 1, joining us here in studio. Frank, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Tom?
Doing well, Frank. Great to have you here in studio for Regionally Speaking. You are back in town after a pretty busy session over in Washington, D.C. Let's go ahead and talk about what you were up to over the last couple of days here in Northwest Indiana, recently touring the harbor and talking about the federal funds that are headed towards or into Northwest Indiana.
Correct. It was a very good day yesterday because we had an opportunity. First of all, thank you for having me, Tom, for Regional Speaking, and thank everyone out there for who's listening. And as we approach the 4th of July, Independence Day, I want everyone to have a safe, wonderful 4th of July. So we were at the harbor yesterday, and ultimately what we were discussing is the delivering of federal dollars to an environmental and economic development projects that we have. The environmental project, we were able to bring $18.3 million to the confined disposal facility in the Indiana Harbor, and also $8.1 million for the Indiana Harbor and the Burns Waterway Harbor. What they're going to do is they're going to dredge that, and they're going to make it more accessible for ships to put more product in it. And if they're heavier, they're going deeper into the river. So what that means is shipping companies can be more efficient and more effective to getting into our steel mills and our steel industries, which allows to shorten our supply chain and to increase our effectiveness to make sure that we're maximizing our loads and really doing all that we can for economic development, so that families who are tied into the steel industry and all those downstream industries are able to produce steel and then be able to provide for their families and be able to get health care benefits and be able to have pensions. So this environmental project, which will also make our rivers cleaner and safer, is also an economic development issue. So was very proud to be there. Also, what we talked about was the ability of the Port of Indiana, which provides for approximately 2,400 jobs. And the Port of Indiana is thriving along with Burns Harbor, meaning a lot of ships, a lot of products are coming in through the different waterways in order to supply our domestic manufacturing here in the United States. That's vitally important to our economy. I think the $5 billion range of the impact of the Port of Indiana, of what it means to business for Indiana. And so with that, I'm working a collaborative effort with state and local agencies. Obviously, myself and the two United States senators find that to be a priority. We've prioritized that, and we were able to deliver funds that could keep on increasing our environmental and economic impact and jobs here locally in the region.
What are you seeing with steelwork here in the region? Obviously, we saw a lot of the an increase in the use of domestic steel following then-President Trump's tariffs against Chinese steel coming in. Overall costs, though, for steel have gone up as we're witnessing inflation woes all across the country right now. What has the steel industry been able to do in the last couple of years following COVID shutdowns and adjustments?
Sure. I think that it's vitally important to talk about when we talk about the steel industry. First, I'm co-chair of the Steel Bipartisan Steel Caucus. Mm-hmm. It's 100 members. Our focal point is to make sure that the industry, the families, the union, the USW, all the steel as a business, hundreds of thousands of jobs throughout our nation, that we're putting them in track and protecting them so that they have an opportunity to thrive.
Yeah.
And that begins with a level playing field. So the tariffs, the Section 232 tariffs, is something as a co-chair of the Steel Caucus, immediately upon being sworn in, we had put a letter forward to the administration to do what we can to make sure that we protect those tariffs. And ultimately, the steel industry was able to thrive during that time. We had a pandemic, and what we realized during the pandemic with the tariffs that are in place to protect our steel industry and create a level playing field for our hardworking men and women and our engineers and the entire steel industry is that we have got to make sure when it comes to national security that the steel industry is protected. And that's why we have these tariffs. So we are in, there's a conflict in Russia with Ukraine.
Right.
We have to be dependent upon American steel. And so as a national security issue, we want to make sure that we're protecting our steel industry. So when we're building ships, when we're building tanks or aircraft carriers or jet planes, that we're using American steel and not dependent on other foreign nations. And so as a economic driving train in Northwest Indiana, we have got to protect that industry and create a level playing field when it comes to trade. So for education for individuals, and what that means is China, for example, they're producing steel and have the ability to have overcapacity, and it's subsidized steel, meaning
by their federal government.
By their federal government. Yeah. So for example, the federal government will pay their electricity bill, or there's no electricity bill in order to manufacture, but they're putting people to work and they're producing all of this steel that floods the market. Then when they release this into the global market, it reduces prices.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why it's so vitally important not only to have Section 232 tariffs, but also good trade policies. Good trade policies across the United States. I, as a North Township trustee, have seen people beyond their control lose jobs because of the unlevel playing field because of trade policies that we've had in the United States. So I believe enforcement. I've testified before the International Trade Commission almost 4 to 5 times, making sure that we're protecting steel industry, making sure we're protecting all domestic manufacturing here in the United States, because it's often too late once it gets to the International Trade Commission where people have lost jobs.
Mm-hmm.
My whole goal, my mission, is to make sure that we're providing jobs and equal opportunities for our families in Northwest Indiana, and we do that with fair trade policies and also with Section 232 to protect the steel industry.
We're talking with Frank Mervan, U.S. Representative for District 1, of course, the former North Township trustee here on Regionally Speaking. Frank, USW workers are, U.S. steel workers are getting set to get into contract negotiations with the union and the steel mills. Can you walk us through sort of that process? I'm an outsider to it. I know a lot of people who work at the mills. I think we all know somebody who works at the mills, if it's not ourselves individually. What is that process like in terms of trying to make sure that both parties are able to come to an agreement? And does it slow down production? Is there any sort of hiccups or any sort of issues when it comes to steel production here in Northwest Indiana?
First, as a federal official, we have no role in the negotiations mm-hmm. between the private company and the USW. To your point, in the past, there is no disruption. Workers continue to work while they're negotiating.
Yeah.
And the steel keeps on rolling through. Ultimately, you know, what my goal is always is that there is a fair balance between productivity and management and the ability for an individual to earn a fair wage, to be able to provide for their families and to have a fair healthcare system or healthcare insurance and make sure that pensioners and pensions are viable for people. And so I just encourage management and labor to find solutions. And ultimately, what my goal is, as we talked about, is to overall protect the steel industry, overall to make a level playing field that hopefully negotiates a contract that both sides win and there is continued growth with profit and continued growth with productivity and continued growth with employment and the ability to increase wages and to have a good healthcare system and a good pension. That's ultimately what my job is to create an environment in which the steel industry can provide that for our working families.
Frank, shifting gears out of the steel industry, but still keeping it here in Northwest Indiana with regards to the environment you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, the dredging of waterways to help with shipping. Northwest Indiana, of course, recently got the newest U.S. National Park at the Indiana Dunes. Let's talk about the environmental impact of Northwest Indiana when it comes to the dollars coming into it in terms of sustaining and being able to hold off beach erosion. Of course, a big issue that we've seen at the dunes in the Portage area, but now controlled by the National Park as well as over in Michigan City. Those dollars coming in, this is, you know, kind of the time of the year when we start to realize, oh, we have these erosion issues. We get into lakeshore flooding issues for individuals who are around the lake. What sort of work is being done at the federal level when it comes to keeping the waterways, especially around Lake Michigan,
sure,
safe?
So we have one of the greatest assets in the state of Indiana, Lake Michigan and the lake shoreline. Congressman Visklowski had the foresight to and the ability to make it a national park. So the Dunes National Park is a designation. It's the first and only national park in the state of Indiana. I grew up at West Beach. Me and my friends, I grew up in Hammond. We would recreate there. We would go there. Our summers were spent there. And so it is a vital part of our community. And so when we talk about the Indiana Dunes, and I talked about collaborative efforts, we had the superintendent of the national park there with us, John Leibowitz. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what we were able to provide is $2.7 million for Indiana Shoreline. That goes to beach erosion. That goes to shoring up eyewalls and seawalls. And what that does is enables to make sure that future generations will have the opportunity to enjoy the Indiana National Dunes. For example, he was telling me a statistic that is staggering. 5 million people will visit the Indiana Dunes this year.
Alone, this year?
Alone. And it competes with Yellowstone. And you can go there, you can have lunch, you could walk the trails, you can enjoy the beach, you can camp. The Indiana Dunes National Park is something that is one of the greatest diamonds that we have. Governor Holcomb was just in when we were talking about the double tracking, mm-hmm. and he said the whole state of Indiana is encouraged, and he's advocating to make sure people visit the dunes because of that number of 5 million people. It's a secret that we want to get out, but ultimately the utilization and the ability to recreate along Lake Michigan is something that I take on as one of my missions to make sure we continue to do that. Specifically to answer your questions there, where I think 250,000 cubic yards of sand at Mount Baldy that the superintendent talked about, yeah, that will make sure for future generations. It's cyclical. When the lake goes increases and decreases, it has cycles, and right now it's at its medium point. And so there is time and effort to make sure that this $2.7 million of Indiana shoreline from, you know, the Hammond area all the way through Michigan City, we shore up not only the shoreline but also the Indiana Dunes National Park. So there is a constant work in progress, and I'm very happy that we were able to secure funding for the Indiana shoreline so that people can recreate and enjoy the Indiana Dunes. And when we talk about 5 million people coming to our area, we have to talk about downtown Chesterton, downtown Velpo, restaurants, shops. Mm-hmm. downtown Gary, all those places that people can go to when they're visiting our area, and then that those economic development dollars or those tourism dollars begin to spread, and it creates opportunities for small businesses. So I'm very proud of our small contribution to the Indiana Dunes when it comes to returning federal taxpayer dollars and making sure that we continue to shore up that as one of the greatest assets Indiana has.
We're talking with Frank Mervan here on Regionally Speaking. Frank, you touched on it, the double track extension. Where do we stand? I know that a lot of roads are closed around Northwest Indiana as folks aren't able to get over, railways right now as work is being done at different points and different junctures. But funding is all the way approved. Are we still waiting on more dollars coming in? Is the full track ready to go ahead and be wrapped up by a certain date? Where are we?
Sure. So currently what we're doing is we are absolutely positively construction is in progress. Mm-hmm. So on last week, Monday, the governor came in, and I think it's important for us to understand, to kind of discuss what double tracking will do. Yep. The double tracking through all the way from South Bend through Michigan City through the going west on the corridor into Chicago will create a double track.
Yep.
So what does that mean? Well, that cuts down the travel time. That cuts down the travel time for a working mom so that she can get home and pay less for childcare. For a father to get home with his family to pay less for childcare. To be able to coach softball. It increases the capacity of the number of trains that will be going back and forth, and it decreases the time it takes to get to Chicago, which is one of the largest economies within the Midwest in our nation, third largest. So that being said, it invests in our future, and it also creates this double tracking based on the cooperation with the governor and also the collaborative effort with the two United States senators, a mm-hmm. bipartisan approach. The funding has been approved. Congressman Visglowski is the champion of the double tracking and the extension of the West Lakes. That being said, what we're doing at where we are currently is they began construction. And so there will be a little bit of dust, and we'll have to excuse mm-hmm. the dust. But the fact of the matter is it'll create economic development. It'll allow for property values to go up. It creates a business incentive with allowing businesses to come in about 7.75 miles within the corridors and to be able to invest. Michigan City has a $80 million private investment to be able to create retail and affordable housing yep. in that general area. So that's an $80 million investment, which will bring in more investment mm-hmm. For Northwest Indiana. And that being said, it is an economic anchor. And so we're very proud of the fact that we are seeing that project to completion. The funding is there, and we will continue to keep an eye on it and make sure that we are moving in the right direction.
Frank, let's shift gears back to Washington, D.C. now. Obviously, the big news of the day is the United States Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. You are up for re-election coming up this fall, and your opponent, Jennifer Ruth Green, is pro-life and believes in the state's rights to choose whether or not to legalize abortion, and she supports Indiana making abortion access illegal. Where do you stand when it comes to abortion, whether it's pro-life or women's right to choose?
Well, I stand with my two daughters and women's rights to have the autonomy to make the choices, the healthcare choices that they need to. I personally believe, you asked me, where do I stand? I stood with almost 1,000 people yesterday in downtown Crown Point that felt like something was taking away from them, that women were less valued than men. What I believe is that elected officials or politicians shouldn't be making healthcare choices for women. I strongly believe that healthcare choices are between the woman, her physician, her family, and I will continue to do that. I am a pro-woman candidate. I'm a pro-woman elected official who has a record, who voted for the Women's Health Act, who voted and co-sponsored that piece of legislation. So what what I had mentioned yesterday to those 600 to 800 people who were there, who wanted to hear their voices heard, that they felt that they were being ignored and they no longer had the autonomy over their body. In my lifetime, I've never seen rights taken away from someone. Mm-hmm. And so that choice and that ability to make that choice is between, as I mentioned, the physician, the family, and the woman. And so it also allows for a woman to be able to make her career and economic choices, along with having an opportunity to participate within our economy. And so I feel very strongly, as I don't say lightly, to make sure that in honor of my two daughters, I will continue to believe in women's rights and advocate for them. So I have a record when it comes to that.
What was the mood on Capitol Hill when that announcement was made?
So the mood on Capitol Hill was thinking of what do we do next? What, as a member of Congress, do we do to protect women's rights? And we are still moving forward. One, we wanted to make sure, I wanted to make sure that people understood where I stand. Two, I wanted to be present. Here, when we're at home, we made sure back when it was released, let's just say 6 to 8 weeks ago when the leak came about the
right.
Supreme Court, a day later, Hobart gathered spontaneously. Some individuals who believed in women's rights absolutely showed up, and I was present. So I want my community, all women, to understand that I stand for women's rights. I stand for them to make that choice, and am going to be working in a collective effort to see what the next step is. So the mood was, as I see it, in my evaluation, is what is the plan of action? How can we be present, and what can we do going forward?
We're talking with Frank Mervan here on Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. She's Dee Dotson.
Hey, Representative Mervan, I just have a question. So I was listening to you earlier speak with Tom Maloney, and you were reflecting on your childhood and being able to just enjoy the Indiana shoreline.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got me to thinking about your dad, who we have had the pleasure of hosting here at Lakeshore Public Radio down through the years. And I just wanted to just ask you a question about the influence that he has had on your life, and even if you can just share some stories that you have learned about not only honesty but integrity in the political world today.
Absolutely. So my father served as a state senator for 40 years. He was an elected official since 1972. He served as a Hammond City Councilman, worked his way up. I guess first and foremost, you hit the nail on the head when you talk about my dad and you talk about integrity and you talk about a man of character who truly loved his job, but very simply loved people. And he made it, the lessons that he taught me was, him and my mother, was to always be present and to make sure that you stand up for people and give people who do not have a voice and to use your talents and skills to advocate for the more vulnerable populations or those that might not have a voice. He also taught me the ability to work across the aisle. You do not have longevity in the Indiana State Legislature and produce results such as he had unless you work together in a collaborative effort in a bipartisan way. I believe that I have done that as a member of Congress. I believe that he instilled that in me. Even to this day, you know, it's more important to him to make sure that there are viable solutions to the challenges that we have than it is who gets credit or what party wins. So ultimately, as a member of Congress, I am a co-chair of the Steel Caucus. We work mm-hmm. in a bipartisan way. Every single day. I am on Veteran Affairs as a committee. I'm chairman of a subcommittee, which is technology modernization. And our responsibility is to make sure that the electronic medical records, which the Department of Defense has one software company and the VA has another. We are working, and there's a transition to make those electronic medical records have interoperability with the Department of Defense so that our veterans receive world-class healthcare, mm-hmm. so that when they leave active service and they become veterans, their medical records will follow them. They don't have to go to a doctor's office and get copies and fax them from one area to the other and work mm-hmm. like it's the 1980s.
Right.
So I bring that up as a bipartisan effort. Also, very, very soon, I hope to see that the PACT Act will pass. Mm-hmm. I'm a co-sponsor of the PACT Act. What that does for all veterans who served in since 2001, Afghanistan, Iraq, mm-hmm. It gives them presumptive medical care for those that were exposed to toxic fumes from burn pits. Mm-hmm. So for 9 forms of cancer and blood disease, mm-hmm. the PACT Act will allow presumptive medical care. An example of that is when Vietnam veterans were exposed to Agent Orange. It mm-hmm. took decades,
right.
decades yes. For them to get health care. In a bipartisan way, led by Democrats, we are able to make sure that veterans receive the world-class health care that they need mm-hmm. and that we remove obstacles so that those individuals can participate in the VA healthcare system and receive the benefits necessary. So I'm very proud of that. So going back mm-hmm. to my father,
right.
He taught me to be honest. He taught me to always stand up for people, and he taught me to use my voice and, more importantly, work in a bipartisan effort in order to find solutions.
Great. So we have about 2 minutes left, and so I have to ask you, what are your plans coming up? As Tom alluded to earlier, you have an opponent mm-hmm. in the general election, but you also have work to do right now. So what are your plans over the summer? What are you going to be focused on?
My plans and my focus is going to be on my district. You know, I've never taken anything for granted, and from day one, we've worked extremely hard within our district and delivering for our district. We are working on not only working with higher education and workforce development in order to get people into the workforce. You know, one thing that is coming up that I find extremely important is our American Competes Act. The American Competes Act is a focal point with our semiconductor and chips. Senator Young is a co-sponsor along with Senator Schumer. I bring that up for one point that it allows us to make sure if I can create the ecosystem. I know we have 2 minutes, but if we're not making cars in South Chicago and our auto workers who live in Northwest Indiana are no longer working, mm-hmm. And that production slows down, then our steel industry slows down, then the downstream industry such as Lear Seating, then those people stop mm-hmm. working.
Right.
So what the American Competes Act is, it is a straightforward way to say that we are going to compete globally and focus on mm-hmm. American domestic manufacturing when it comes to semiconductor chips and chips. And ultimately what I'm competing for, if you can close your eyes and envision this, is that there are going to be 15 tech hubs throughout the United States. And we have an opportunity to compete because of the collaborative effort with the governor, with higher learning, with education, our workforce, our educated workforce, to be one of those tech hubs, which will allow us to look at the next generation of jobs, of engineers, of workers who will make a livable wage within those industries. And so I find that act extremely important going forward. So when we talk about the election, of course I'm going to be out talking to the people about what we've delivered for community-funded projects, with economic development, within clean environment, how we're creating jobs, how we're protecting the steel industry, how we're looking to the future for future jobs. So ultimately, I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing, and I am not running against an opponent. I'm running for Congress. When I was a North Township trustee, when we were absolutely at the table with people who found themselves in circumstances beyond their control, no one ever asked me what party I was from. We found solutions. We worked with social services. We worked with Work One. We worked with whoever necessary, the faith-based community, to find solutions. I will continue to do that, and I will tell that narrative from every block and every corner of Northwest Indiana.
That's Frank Mervan, United States District 1 Congressman, joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Frank, thank you so much for your time. I'm Tom Maloney. She's Dee Dotson. Thanks for tuning in.